Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The question presented for this appeal is whether it was objectively reasonable for the appellants to consider Geldwin's assertions in a parallel case to understand the true amount in controversy for purposes of removal to federal court. It was reasonable because Geldwin had previously asserted a breach of contract claim in this dispute, resulting in return of additional money, and we take that amount of money and add it to the amount admittedly in controversy that exceeds the diversity threshold. The appellants unsuccessfully attempted a removal to the Western District of Wisconsin. The district court held that the facts and the pleadings from a parallel case in Oklahoma involving the same parties, arising from the same business relationship, involving the same disputed invoices, was not relevant to the Wisconsin state court complaint. The district court first held that the removal statute was a fee-shifting statute, then upon reconsideration corrected the applicable standard, but nevertheless held that the removal was objectively unreasonable. This court in Lott v. Pfizer held that the objectively reasonable standard is met when removal is contrary to clearly established law. And the removal statute encourages litigants to make liberal use of the federal courts so long as the right to remove is not abused. We did not abuse the removal statute in our removal. It was entirely reasonable to review that complaint submitted in state court and understand that the diversity threshold had been met. The complaint states that the dispute arises from Geldwin's sale of wood window products to my client. The theories of liability, including breach of contract, only arise from an alleged excess discount.
One important principle of federal jurisdiction is that the amount in controversy can't exceed the amount that the defendant would have to pay to fully satisfy the plaintiff's demands. Couldn't you have satisfied the plaintiff's demands fully by tendering $42,000 at the time?
Well, Your Honor, had we done that, we would have admitted there was a breach of contract.
No. Paying a demand doesn't admit to breach of contract. You probably draft all the time settlement agreements that say, in settling this, we deny, but we'd rather pay our adversary than our lawyers, or something like that.
Well, our analysis is what the plaintiffs reasonably hoped to get out of the litigation. And while they certainly wanted the $42,000, what they also wanted was a finding by the jury of a breach of contract. That breach could only have been the exclusive supply agreement, or ESA, signed between the parties. The complaint filed in Wisconsin only attaches a credit application. That document is completely silent as to any pricing or any discount. So we naturally understood.
I'm puzzled. Wisconsin enforces rules against claim splitting, I assume. So what you're saying now is that we're worried the jury would order us to pay $42,000 and they would have the preclusive effect of the jury verdict, and so maybe they'd sue us again for breach of contract. But as a matter of state law, that couldn't happen, could it?
Well, it would. It couldn't happen, but they would also have the right, I believe, to demand a return of the $33,000, because the issue of whether there was a breach of the contract would have been finalized, and there would have been collateral estoppel as to whether or not there was a breach of the ESA.
It's over. Once the jury returns its verdict, the suit is over. They're in no position to demand any more money without filing a separate suit, which, as you say, they, under the state law of preclusion, they can't file.
Well, I think that they could file a separate demand for the $33,000 just based on the finding of a breach of contract. And I don't think it was absolutely necessary.
Is that a matter of Wisconsin procedure? I mean, let's take the sequence. Case goes to trial with a $42,000 demand. The jury returns a verdict in the plaintiff's favor. And the plaintiff says, and now, Judge, we'd like you to add $33,000 because the jury's verdict implies that we win on another theory as well. So please add $33,000. Suppose that request is made. What happens as a matter of Wisconsin law? Is that a good request or a bad request?
I understand that that would be a good request, and that was precisely our concern when we removed the case to...
What happened to the right of jury trial in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't think that they would need a jury trial for a return of the $33,000 once they establish any breach of the ESA. Any breach, according to them in Oklahoma, triggers return.
Does it matter Wisconsin law, once there is a breach of contract, the judge rather than the jury determines the damages?
Well, if
even after the trial has already been held?
Well,
Where do we go in Wisconsin law to see an example of that? Is there some case where the Supreme Court of Wisconsin says, after the jury's verdict, the plaintiff can make an additional monetary demand and the judge can grant it?
Well, the additional demand would have been an interpretation of the contract, what the contract requires.
But not a claim ever presented to the jury. The question is, what Wisconsin case should I look at to see that that's an appropriate way to proceed in Wisconsin?
I don't have a case cite for Your Honor, but it was always...
There isn't some... It's a very counterintuitive approach. It surely would not be allowed in federal court. I'm perfectly willing to believe that a state might allow it, but there has to be some evidence that the state does allow it, right? Some case that says, or some rule or some statute that permits that approach?
Well, my understanding of the rules of pleading in Wisconsin is that the pleadings are to be liberally construed and additional claims be brought at the time.
It's not a question of pleading, right? As far as I understand Wisconsin's rules of procedure, they're very similar to the federal rules. The pleadings drop out by the summary judgment stage. They're completely irrelevant by the time of trial. We're just trying to figure out what is a lawful means of proceeding in Wisconsin. You know, in federal practice, this would be described as an editor. And there's a big problem between editor and the Seventh Amendment. It doesn't happen without the other party's consent. But maybe it does in Wisconsin. That's why I'm asking, is there some rules, some case, something?
Well, the civil procedure statutes are codified as Section 802, and my understanding of Section 802 has always been that the evidence, that the pleadings and the theories of liability submitted to the jury are to conform to the evidence. So my understanding, and I would disagree with His Honor, is
that's a completely different point. If your point is that at the close of the trial, the jury would be told that it can bring back a verdict of $75,233, I think isn't that the total, adding them up? If that's what the jury could be told, then one would think the case is removable. But you began by saying the jury would bring back a verdict for $42,000 and then the judge would add $33,333. And I was trying to figure out whether that could be right. The proposition the jury could be told to bring back a verdict of $75,233 is a different point. So which of these is your point?
It's the latter point, is that my understanding is that the jury could be told that the proper damages would include this return of the exclusivity consideration paid at the outset if the jury were to find a breach.
That rule is not construed under Wisconsin law to permit the addition of entirely new and unpleaded claims at the time of the jury instruction conference.
Well, at trial, we would have submitted the ESA for consideration, and that this is indeed the true document that expresses the alleged excess discount. And so, if for no other reason, as a defense to their claim of breach of contract, we would have submitted the ESA, then they could have come in and said, well, if they're saying the ESA is at issue, then we are going to demand return of the $33,000. And that's why we are disturbed at the very artful pleading and the differences between the Wisconsin and the Oklahoma pleadings. In Oklahoma, they admit that it is the ESA that governs this excess discount. And so their first and second counterclaims in Oklahoma are breach of contract theories of liability, and the second counterclaim says that any breach triggers return of the $33,000. We strongly believe that there must be consistency in the plea.
Puzzled by the idea that the defendant can increase the stakes of the case. Suppose the plaintiff sues for $10,000, and the defendant says, if the plaintiff wins, I'm going to commit suicide. The value of my life exceeds $75,000. Therefore, this $10,000 case is removable because I'm just going to fall on my sword, and that's a really big stake. Can a defendant remove on that kind of theory?
Not on that kind of theory, Your Honor. But
that sounds like what your current argument is, that at trial we would fall on our sword, and that would increase the amount to more than $75,000.
Our concern is what they would have done at trial after we proffer the ESA in defense of their claim, to say this is the true amount of the excess discount, 51% off-list price. It says what it says. And that is our natural defense. They knew we were going to have to assert a defense like that. That's the only document that expresses this alleged excess discount. I see that my time has expired, and I will turn this over to my colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Beckman. Mr. Moser.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Moser. I appear on behalf of Gelbman, Inc. in this matter. The threshold question for this Court to consider is what, on June 21, 2007, did clearly established law say about how a party should calculate the amount of controversy for purposes of diversity?
Counsel, let me begin by telling you what worries me most, and that's Wisconsin Statute 806.01C, which is just like Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54C, and it says every final judgment grants the relief to which the party is entitled, whether he asked for it in the pleadings or not. And that's the sort of argument the defendant is making, which is that amount asked for in the pleadings is not conclusive. We need to know what the party is entitled to. And the defendant is saying if they're entitled to anything, they're entitled to $75,000 odd. We think they're entitled to nothing. But under 806.01C, doesn't that create a bona fide dispute about the $75,000?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. The reason for that, as is set forth in our brief, and to some extent was also set forth in the summary judgment pleadings filed by the defendants in this matter at the time Judge Shabazz remanded the matter, is essentially the fact that to recoup the exclusivity consideration, which is the $33,000 figure that's been referred to, looking at the exclusive supply agreement, you would have to give notice, Gelbman would have had to give notice, given a cure opportunity to the defendants before it could have terminated the ESA and sued on the basis of that failure to repay money. That's never happened. In fact, what happened in this case is that Gelbman was not even aware it had this claim until well after the time it passed in Oklahoma to amend its pleadings in the pending state court case in Oklahoma between the parties. We don't believe there was ever a factual scenario under which Gelbman could have made an argument that it was entitled to get the $33,000. We don't necessarily agree with everything that CDK has said regarding our inability to recover on the credit application or recover on our complaint. But the factual scenario that would result in Gelbman being able to get the $33,000 in the Wisconsin case does not exist.
So it would involve a breach of a different section of the contract than is at issue in the case that you brought in Wisconsin?
We believe that our recovery would be based upon the credit application, which was attached to the state court complaint. It's a document executed in, I believe, April of 2003. And that the exclusive supply agreement does not control our ability to file suit and collect under for the unpaid obligations that we have pled in the Wisconsin state court complaint. Looking at the complaint that was filed in this case, it's clear that Gelbman is seeking much less than $75,000. Gelbman itemized its claim, which came out to $41,892.02. Gelbman did indicate in its complaint it was seeking prejudgment interest, which cannot be included in the amount in controversy, and also indicated it believed it had a contractual entitlement to its attorney's fees and costs associated with collection. The amount of fees and costs pending at the time of, or that it accrued at the time of removal, were fully disclosed to Judge Shabazz in Gelbman's trial court pleadings on the question of remand, and at the time, I believe, totaled $2,831.42. Instead of looking at clearly...
By the way, what happened to this case? After it went back to Wisconsin, what happened?
You're asking what happened after the initial August decision or the October decision?
After it was remanded to state court, what happened?
almost simultaneously with the motion to reconsider that was filed by the CDK parties, they filed a motion to dismiss with the Russ County Circuit Court, which was the state court that had this jurisdiction. That issue was fully briefed. During the pendency of that pleading, CDK sought to appeal to this court, and as it stands right now, all state court activity has stayed as a result of this appeal.
I'm totally lost why the state court wouldn't proceed to decision, but at least I know what's happening. The state court is sitting on the case waiting for it to hatch.
Yes. I believe that the clerk in that court felt that they could not continue the case up there because they'd return the entire record to the district court. I don't know if they could have made a copy or not, but it's not in the record. That's my understanding of why they are waiting.
Once it's remanded, the record is in the state court.
I know it was temporarily, at least. But essentially what the complaint says is we want $41,892 plus fees and costs, and that's the pot of money which counts to the amount of controversy. If on June 21, 2007, instead of filing the notice of removal, CDK had presented a check in full satisfaction denying all liability in that amount and added on some money for what they presumed to be fees and costs, or given us a blank check for fees and costs, this case would have been over. What instead has happened is that the CDK parties have attempted to distort Gelman's claim in this case and analogize it to situations in which plaintiffs either plead amounts over certain thresholds because, as I understand, the applicable provisions in Illinois law or potentially in Indiana law that restrict what amounts can be set forth in complaints, or they analogize this to cases where there's been some question about whether a party should have been aligned on one side or the other of the fence for purposes of diversity jurisdiction. Throughout the briefing in this case, both at the district court level and this court level, there has not been one case cited which says under these facts and circumstances any of their arguments regarding the amount of controversy hold water. Looking at the initial notice of removal, they included interest, which is clearly not allowed. They improperly aggregated theories of recovery, which was clearly not allowed. And we have these vague references to claims in Oklahoma, which are not pending in any way in the Wisconsin case. Subsequent to our motion to remand, added to that were claims regarding the exclusive supply agreement and also speculation that the CDK parties might ultimately file a counterclaim at some stage in litigation. The record, though, before the district court shows no counterclaim was ever filed, and frankly, as the district court found, that was irrelevant. The question of was there subject matter jurisdiction based on amount of controversy goes back to the time of removal. Now, certainly things that happen after removal shed light on whether that subject matter jurisdiction existed, but you can't engage in hypothetical reasoning or speculation about what a party might do in order to create subject matter jurisdiction where none exists. This complaint essentially gives a clear black and white picture to the opposing party of what Gelman is claiming. They can litigate it, they can settle it, but under any theory, there was no basis to conclude this went over the $75,000 threshold. There has been an argument made, sort of tangential to this case regarding a parallel proceeding. There was a motion to dismiss filed at the district court level claiming this was a parallel proceeding. Gelman opposed that. I won't get into all of our rationale there, but essentially our position was that we were suing for a very discrete piece of money we believe Gelman was entitled to, as opposed to the same thing or the same factual allegations that were present in the Oklahoma case. Our claim was very discreet. It was limited to an incorrect discount on invoices generated by a single Gelman factory located in Russ County, Wisconsin. As I indicated before, those amounts were itemized, provided in a table attached to the complaint for CDK parties review. And there's never been a claim by Gelman, a pleading by Gelman, a document by Gelman, or a statement by Gelman at any point along the way that anybody can point to where Gelman has ever taken the position that its claim was worth more than $75,000. So we come back to what's in the complaint, and there simply is no case which says we should ever go beyond that. The circuit court had the opportunity to consider this. It exercised its discretion. It awarded fees. It was met with a motion to reconsider, which only served to correct the circuit court's incorrect use of the Garby decision as opposed to the Martin decision. But in fact, in the briefing prior to the circuit court's August decision, the district court's August decision, the CDK parties had not opposed the award of attorney's fees. And as we've stated in our brief, I believe that this court should also consider in its discretion awarding us fees incurred in connection with this appeal. Otherwise, it essentially renders the district court's decision a hollow victory for Jeldwin. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Beckman, your time has expired, but we asked a lot of questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your Honor, when we looked at that Wisconsin complaint, we were not engaging in the hypothetical. We were looking to see where is this breach of contract coming from. The credit application, completely silent as to pricing or a discount. We naturally understood that the EOSA was issue, and then we naturally looked at what happened in Oklahoma and what the allegations are pled by them and how this case would turn out. I don't think that's a hypothetical. I think that there has to be consistency in the pleadings, and really the issue here on the appeal is whether or not we are objectively reasonable, whether or not we were abusing the process. We weren't abusing the
consistency doctrine, consistency requirement.
Pardon me?
Does Wisconsin have a consistent pleading requirement?
I don't believe so, but I believe that as a matter of principle, there ought to be consistency between Oklahoma, what they say in Oklahoma, and what they say in Wisconsin as to what this controversy is about an excess discount. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.